From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. New Hanover County is seeing a rise in the number of children in need of foster homes. While the reasons for the increase aren't quite clear, public officials are taking another look at services for kids who have been removed from their family homes because of abuse or neglect. There's also legislation on the table that would divert more funding to prevent kids coming out of foster care from heading straight into homelessness. We'll hear about the proposed legislation today, the issues facing kids that wind up in the foster care system, and what it takes to become a foster parent. Joining us in studio today, Liz Kakris-Jones is the district administrator of the 5th Judicial District for Guardian Ad Litem, which oversees volunteers who act as advocates for children in the North Carolina court system. Liz Kakris-Jones, welcome to Coastline.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Also with us today, Neely Pelling is a social worker with the New Hanover County Department of Social Services. She specializes in foster home licensing and child placement. Neely Pelling, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you have a question about foster care or if you have an experience in the foster care system that you'd like to share, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also reach us by email at coastline@whqr.org. Neely Pelling, how many kids in New Hanover County are currently in custody of the Department of Social Services right now?
As of April 30th, 2015, we had 352 children in the custody of New Hanover County Department of Social Services.
And what does that mean in terms of where these kids are? Are all of them placed in foster homes?
They're not. They're placed. We have 103 foster homes, and we have, out of the 352 kids, 185 of them are in a licensed foster home. The rest of those kids would be placed with relatives and kinship placements. And a small number of kids, I think there are 30 of them, are in group homes or in an institution or a hospital.
Liz Kakris-Jones, how does Guardian Ad Litem work with the Department of Social Services to help these children?
We're their legal advocates. We're the children's legal advocates. So that means that every court matter that affects the children, we're there representing kind of what they need in terms of their best interest specifically. And so we work very, very closely with the Department of Social Services because the department is their legal guardian. And we are their legal advocate. And so we do a lot of intersecting and work together on that.
And you work with New Hanover County, but Pender County is also part of your district.
That's correct.
So how many kids are you serving?
We serve 404 children as of April 30th also. So obviously the predominance of children we serve are in New Hanover County. It's the larger population center. So.
And Neely Pelling with New Hanover County DSS, you have said that 350 children in the system is a large number for the county. Is that right?
It is. Yes, it is. And we've recently seen an increase. We've had a lot of kids come into custody, I would say, in this year so far since January. Our numbers are up and we, you know, really are trying to get out there and recruit for more foster families so we can keep kids in New Hanover County and they can stay in their same school and, you know, maintain some normalcy.
Liz Kakris-Jones with Guardian Ad Litem, is this something that is unique to New Hanover County, or are you also seeing a spike in the number of kids who need services in Pender County as well?
Well, I'll answer start with, it depends, which is our mantra in our program. So having said that, the change comes more specifically where there's a population center, right? And so Wilmington is our population center for the region. And so people who need services are, there's an influx of them into the Wilmington area, which certainly makes sense that New Hanover County DSS is responding and needing to respond to that need. Having said that, what we have seen in Pender County is it's gone up and it goes down and it goes up and it goes down. So it kind of stays around the same number, but it'll spike and drop. And over time, it looks pretty much like an average stability.
So is population growth part of the reason then for the spike? Are there other reasons, Neely Pelling, for the increase in the number of kids who need services? Or is this just tied to the growth in population here?
I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure what the spike is about. I mean, I don't know if it's the population growth. I really don't know.
Why does a kid come into the system? Why do children become? Why does DSS become the legal guardian of a child? What sends a kid into the system and away from his or her family?
It's due to neglect or abuse by a parent or caretaker.
And how do you find out about that?
What happens is a call comes into the Department of Social Services, and those calls are answered by social workers. And it can be from a concerned citizen, anyone in the community, the school, hospitals, and people report a concern about either neglect or abuse. And they assign that to a social worker that goes out and meets with the family and assesses the situation and tries to work with the family to keep kids in the home, put some services in place to try and let the family remain together. But if that can't happen, and, you know, the most common reasons children come into custody are domestic violence, drug abuse, and mental health issues with the parents. And if it's not safe for the children to stay there, then they are removed. A petition is filed and signed by a judge that gives us custody of the children, and they're placed either at that time with a relative, if they have someone that's appropriate that is in the area where they can go and stay, then we always look to relatives. And if not, then they come into a family foster home.
And how long might a child be in a foster home? Is reunification with the family always the goal, or are there cases when a child is just removed permanently from the family?
I would say it's always the goal. If there's any way that we can get children back home, and there are terrible things that can happen that would eliminate maybe a possible parent forever having reunification, but we would look to the other parent to see if that would be a plan for the child to start either building a relationship with that non-offending parent and going towards a reunification with that non-offending parent. But I would say that it's safe to say that all of the goal is always reunification. It doesn't always happen, but it always starts out as the goal for children to be returned to a birth parent.
And Liz Kakris-Jones, can you tell us what it's like for a child who has come to guardian ad litem and has been assigned a volunteer? What will that child experience with the volunteer through the court system?
Well, keeping in mind that, as Neely pointed out, you know, all the things that have happened before the child's removed from their family. The child is traumatized. The family's in chaos. The child is traumatized. And so then they, you know, if they're with a family member, that's wonderful, that's familiar, that's very helpful in them feeling safe and stable and not having to adjust to a number of new changes. But the volunteer's first and foremost goal is to see the child, see where they are, see where they're living, assess that environment, assess what types of supports and services might be needed around the issues of trauma, and so that we make sure that children get the services that they need. The volunteer then is always visiting the child, talking to the social worker, and then intersecting with our staff in order to present a report to the judge that is on the best interest of the child. And so while Neely's pointed out that the mandate is always, and it's an appropriate mandate, to look at reunification, we look at best interest. That's our mandate. And sometimes we have to weigh that against the mandate of reunification and make possibly different recommendations.
How often does that happen when the recommendation of the social worker or the goal of the social worker for reunification differs from the assessment with guardian ad litem?
It's not that often, really, because it is appropriate for children to go back to their parents if that's possible. So I would say, you know, probably more than 90% of the time, if we're working really hard together and sharing all the information we have, we come to very similar conclusions. Sometimes our differences are a matter of degree. Things like, should a child go home or to one of a number of relatives? We might pick one. They might pick another. Might be how quickly the child returns to a parent. we might want to have that happen either sooner or later than the department. We might be looking at different factors with regard to siblings. Things like that might weigh in on why we would differ. It's rare, very rare, that we would be completely divergent.
Can you think of a circumstance when that's happened? And what? And I certainly realize that these are confidential circumstances, but can you describe sort of the general situation?
So I can give you a general in the sense that I don't want to speak too much in jargon. So there are things that can happen along the way for a child, and we are involved for usually a couple of years, 1 to 2 years typically, before the family can correct what's happening if they're doing everything they need to do. And along the way, we're looking at a kind of a alternate plan if parents don't do what they need. So one of the options 2 years in might be a termination of parental rights and adoption for that child as opposed to a family member. And what might be on the table in terms of discussion is there a family member that should adopt? Is there a foster parent that should adopt? Is there, you know, looking at that? And we might have different ideas about who is the best choice for adoption, and that could be a major difference.
And so the guardian ad litem volunteer has quite a bit of influence then in the outcome for a child.
Yes, yes. We are a party at the table. The department is a party. We are a party. We represent the child's interest, and then the parents are a party.
And is there ever a conflict between, and we're going to go to break in just a second, and maybe we can come back and answer this, but between someone who's a professional social worker versus someone who's just a volunteer and has that sort of the volunteer authority?
What's the question? Is there a conflict?
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about sort of a professional perspective versus, right. And I'm getting the wrap up from our producer, but we will come back in just a moment. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about children in custody at New Hanover County's Department of Social Services. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. I'm here with Liz Kakris-Jones of Guardian Ad Litem and Neely Pelling from the New Hanover County Department of Social Services. We're talking today about children in the foster care system, the need for foster parents and child advocates. Have you ever been in the foster care system, either as a child or a parent? Tell us about it by calling 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. You can also ask a question of our guests and tweet us at CoastlineHQR. Just before we went to break, I was clumsily asking a question about when there's a divergence between the professional opinion of, say, a social worker versus the opinion of a volunteer from Guardian Ad Litem. And while you've acknowledged that that is a pretty rare occurrence, your mandates are slightly different. And how do you work that out when there is a conflict? How does that ultimately resolve? Neely Pelling.
Well, ultimately, the decision is the judge's to make. And we present in court. The department has a court report that is given to the judge, as does the guardian ad litem. And so the judge will hear testimony and look at the reports, and then it is ultimately his decision what we will do moving forward.
And Neely, you specialize in licensing foster parents. Can you tell us what it means to become a foster parent, the process that someone would go through?
Sure. It's about, it takes usually 3 to 6 months to become a foster parent. One of the first steps is just calling and getting information and scheduling a time for one of us to come out and meet and get to know you. And then we have a class that's called MAP. It's Model Approach to Partnerships and Parenting. And that's really the first step beyond just meeting with a social worker. And that's a 30-hour pre-service class that we offer 4 times a year. And it really gives foster parents or potential foster parents all the information they need to decide if fostering is for them. And after they have completed that class, we do a comprehensive home study, and you have to have criminal background checks and medical clearance and things like that. And then once we're done with the application, it's sent off to the state office. And there's three people in the state office in Black Mountain, North Carolina, that review all of the applications for foster homes. And so that can sometimes, depending on how busy they are, take 4 to 6 weeks for a home to be licensed. So it's about a three to six month process to become licensed. And then as soon as you're licensed and show up on the state list, we start calling because we really need foster parents.
And of course, this is an extremely vulnerable population, the kids who wind up in the system. And both of you, with your respective organizations, Guardian Ad Litem and DSS, you would have to be on guard against predators.
Right.
And this would certainly, these both would be logical places for predators to go. So what are the red flags for you and how do you weed them out? Not all predators, of course, have criminal records. The criminal record, as we know, is only there if there have been convictions in
right.
the past. So what do you look for, Neely Pelling?
Well, I think that you have to trust your instincts when we're assessing families that want to foster. And we require a lot of work from them on the front end of when they're going through the training. And there's a lot of questions they have to answer. And we really say you have to be an open book. We really need you to be open and honest about your childhood, your experiences, things that have happened in your life that have brought you to us wanting to become a foster parent. And we it can sometimes feel like we're so desperate for foster parents and we really need them, but then we make it really difficult to become one. And that is true because we have to make sure that the kids are safe. I mean, the last thing we want to happen is kids be removed from their own birth home because of neglect and abuse and then put them in a home where they're exposed to those same things. So it really is a comprehensive home study. We really get to know our families. We teach the MAP class. So we get to know them in class as part of where they're doing their homework, and we just really have to use our assessment skills. And if anything feels funny, we go back out. We can team up together and meet with people, and we really want to make sure that we feel like we really know the families that we are sending children to live with.
And so you're talking about your spidey senses. You listen to those. But are there things that you can quantify? Are there red flags that you've seen in the past where you've said, oh, that's not going to work, or this a child might not be safe with this person? And what are those things?
Well, I can't think of an example where I really felt like there was a red flag. But the state requires that if you've had any major life change that you wait to pursue getting licensed a year, at least a year. And there have been times when I feel like maybe if someone's in a custody battle and you know, it doesn't seem like the right time. And so we really talk about what it seems like you have a lot going on in your own life with your own child. And we have had that happen before, where they've gotten licensed, but where people have come to us and they're, you know, feeling that maybe it would help their case or do feel like they're a very good parent and want to prove that and things like that. Of course, we do fingerprint clearance and criminal background checks, and that's kind of an easy red flag because if anything comes up on that that's the least bit questionable, then I mean, we don't have to license people. You know, I mean, we do have that option to say thank you, but no thank you.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about children in the custody of New Hanover County's Department of Social Services, how they end up there, what they need, what they're likely to face in the future. Here in the studio to answer your questions are Neely Pelling with the Department of Social Services in New Hanover County and Liz Kakris-Jones of Guardian Ad Litem. If you have a question about foster care or an experience in the system to share, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Liz Kakris-Jones, what is the screening process like for a volunteer at Guardian Ad Litem, and how do you guard against potential predators?
We have as high level a screening process as we've been able to implement, and I feel like it's a pretty high level. We have the obligation to be credible witnesses to the court, and so we do have criminal background check, we do fingerprint checks, we do personal references, we also have a personal interview. They have to go through 30 hours of pre-service training, and all of that is part of our comprehensive look at, is this a good fit for folks and for us? And so my conversation with people when we you know, start to have concerns about fit are to say, you know, I know what I'm going to ask of you as a volunteer. And we have a really high standard to put in front of the court. And we have a really vulnerable population that we are trying to serve. And so putting those two things together, even though right now I need volunteers, I am not going to lower my standards because the children deserve the highest standard we can offer. And so I will have sometimes very difficult conversations with people about, you know, I know what we're going to expect of you, or I need, you know, you to respond to these inquiries for me. Our interview is very in-depth, much like Neely was pointing out. We have to look at the history and the motivation behind the folks who want to volunteer. And they're not even going to be daily caregivers to the children. You can't have been convicted of a felony because you're an impeachable witness. So we have all sorts of things we look at. We put it all together and make decisions based on kind of the conglomeration of information.
And certainly if a criminal background check comes back and there's something there that, as Neely said, is an obvious red flag. Mm-hmm. But are there less obvious red flags where you've just decided to exclude someone from consideration because of your spidey senses or because there's something that comes up that you can't quite quantify?
Yeah, we have the ability to make those decisions based on, you know, our own insight. And I think we, you know, I've been doing this work for the last, well, my entire career, but with Guardian Ad Litem for 16 years. And so I've come to trust and learned which questions I need to ask of people. But absolutely, there are times when I just have that conversation with folks that, you know, this just doesn't feel like it's going to be a good fit. I understand that you feel like it will be, but I have to go on what I think is the best information I have. And this information is not confirming for me that this is the right direction for us.
Just lately, when you Google news for foster care and foster parents, it's amazing the number of cases that come up across the country where people have been arrested for preying on children that are supposed to be in their care. And just, you know, a sort of random rundown from yesterday, May 11th in Maine, a Belfast man is in jail after he turned himself in and allegedly admitted to sexually assaulting one of his foster care children. May 5th in Broward County, Florida, a foster child filed a lawsuit against his parent, alleging he was abused by his foster parent. Calgary, that's Canada. Former foster parent of the year, sentenced to 10 years for sexually abusing four boys in his care. April 28th in El Paso, Texas. You know, it goes on and on and on. And I'm certain that most people who offer themselves as foster parents have good intentions and want to help. But why is this so prevalent? And are we in any kind of denial here, or are we just lucky?
Well, I think that those examples are also things that we can reference when we're telling people, you know, leave no stone unturned in your life story. I mean, we really need to know you because we never want kids to be victimized again. You know, is it prevalent? You know, when you look at anywhere, there are people out there that are hurting children, teachers, you know, lots of people. And I think that we have so many foster homes and so many foster parents that really want to help kids and want to make a difference in their life. And, you know, true pedophiles are very resourceful, and they will figure out a way to get close to children. And we've seen that. We've seen that, you know, and that those are the stories that are in the news. It's like, how did they even have that opportunity? And it's like, well, they've you know, made it their mission to do that. And so we never want that to happen. And I think we have to be so careful, because you're right, it doesn't mean that just because they have a clean criminal records check that they're not out there to hurt children. But we also have so many people in the foster homes. The guardian ad litem is out there, you know, sometimes weekly. The social workers out there, if they have more than one child in their home, then all the children have a social worker and have a guardian ad litem. You know, we try to really know what's going on in the home, who the people are that are there. Anyone, if there's any adult children in the home, if they're over the age of 18, they have to have fingerprint clearance. If they're over 21, they have to be part of the foster home license. So we really try to be careful about that. But we do tell foster parents when they come to us or potential foster parents that that is why it's so difficult to become a foster parent. That's why we have to make sure that we're putting kids in a safe environment. And I think that helps them understand, because a lot of times people come to us and they're like, you know, I feel like this is my calling. I want to help. And we're like, that's great. Now get ready for, you know, 3 to 6 months worth of background checks and interviews and class and paperwork. But I think people that really are invested and want to make a difference understand that there's a reason why we have to do that. Because the ultimate goal is always for children to be safe, especially when they're in foster care.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about children in the custody of New Hanover County's Department of Social Services. Here in the studio to answer your questions are Neely Pelling with the Department of Social Services in New Hanover County and Liz Kakris-Jones of Guardian Ad Litem. If you have a question or an experience you'd like to share, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Liz from Guardian Ad Litem.
Thanks, Rachel. I just wanted to continue what Neely was saying, because I think what you're pointing out in those headlines is the fact that what we know about pedophiles is that they, one, they're very savvy, and two, they choose victim children intentionally. They choose children who are very vulnerable. They choose children who they think are easily discredited. They choose children who don't have good network supports around them. And they do that in a very deliberate way. And so while it's heartbreaking just to hear you read that list of headlines, the truth is that the folks who work closest with children are certainly thinking about the fact that they know those indicators for predatory behavior, and that we're always trying to be very mindful of that and keep in mind that children speak to us in ways that aren't as clear as what systems and maybe the general public would think. They give us information about how they're being treated that isn't just, I'm being hurt, or they're not that direct.
How do they give you information, Liz?
I think that they do all sorts of behaviors. Sometimes they withdraw. Sometimes they don't eat. Sometimes they act out. Sometimes they are, I think we talked earlier about the word sassy. You know, people who are kids who can be really challenging in their behavior. Sometimes those kids are telling us really important things, and they're coping in really appropriate ways for what their experience is. And so to try and rely as a general public on just direct information from children is to do a disservice to the child. We need to take the way that children speak, especially vulnerable children speak, which is not to just tell you, somebody just hurt me. They won't do it. They will give you other information in other ways, nonverbal and else.
And how will a guardian ad litem volunteer see that? Is it taking the child out to lunch and just having a friendly chat? Or is it visiting the home, the foster home where the child is staying? How does that information come to a volunteer?
Well, one of the important pieces of how our volunteers are directed is that they are not allowed to transport children, and they're not allowed to kind of be a supervisor of children. So what they do is they visit the children in a number of different settings and try to have, you know, meaningful conversations with them. So they do go to the foster home. They do go to the school. They'll go to a daycare provider, any number of ways. And they have to kind of cultivate really good rapport building skills based on what they know about that child. And so hopefully, and it has happened, that children have reported that, you know, they're having a hard time in home or, you know, just with a certain item because they've spent the time getting to know the child.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about foster care in New Hanover County with Guardian Ad Litem. And we have Nadia from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. I understand, Nadia, you have a unique situation. Tell us about it.
Yes. I was actually in foster care from the age of 13 to 14, And I just graduated my master's in social work like two Fridays ago from UNCW.
So. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a lot to celebrate.
And what was your experience that year that you spent in foster care? What was it like?
Well, I mean, it's so weird when people ask me because that's my normal. You know, like, I don't know what it's like to not have been in foster care and not have changed families. And I was really lucky because my foster family adopted me. And it's not very common for teenagers to be adopted. And so I was really, really blessed.
Well, congratulations on that. And as you start your social work career, Nadia, what do you hope to do?
Well, I actually spent some time at DSS. I did Pender County DSS for almost 2 years with UNCW doing a mixture of CPS and clinical social work. But now I'm looking at doing more of the clinical piece, doing therapy with children in their homes and just keeping the family together.
Well, that's excellent. Congratulations to you, Nadia. And thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the broadcast. It's awesome, and I hope to see more foster families signing up.
All right. Thanks so much. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about foster care in New Hanover County. We have about a minute before we go to break. Neely Pelling, can you just give us kind of a rough demographic breakdown of the children who are in the system at this point in terms of age and ethnicity? Who do we see most?
I don't have a breakdown of that. Do you have a breakdown?
I do.
Liz has a breakdown.
The demographics for our children, typically in terms of age, under 12 and under. So you would see probably 75% of the children in care who are young, you know, 0 to 12. Kids coming into foster care as teenagers, for a while that was really on the rise nationally and locally, and that's kind of flattened out, but still probably 25% of the children that we serve, based on my data, is 12 to 18.
Mm-hmm. So, and from an ethnic standpoint?
Okay. I would say, based on my most recent look, it was, you know, still majority of children white, but disproportionately you still have, based on our community, I think at least more than 30% to 40% of our children are African American, and maybe another 5% Latino.
You're listening to Coastline. We'll be back in 90 seconds. If you have an experience, give us a call, 910-343-1138. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Neely Pelling of the New Hanover County DSS and Liz Kakris-Jones from Guardian Ad Litem. We're talking about foster care and foster parenting. If you have a question for our guests today, or if you have an experience in the foster care system as a child or as a parent, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. Or tweet us at CoastlineHQR. And we do have an email question from Paul. He says, my partner and I have discussed fostering a child as an unmarried gay couple. How does that work? Are there laws against this? And has legal gay marriage improved the ability to foster? Finally, we are considering getting married here in North Carolina. Should we wait to foster until we do? Neely Pelling.
Well, we have always licensed same-sex couples, married couples, single people. I mean, we need all kinds of foster families, so that's never been an issue. What we've seen, what has changed as far as same-sex couples and adopting is that now both people in the relationship can adopt, which has been huge because before it wasn't recognized as a union and only one of the foster parents could adopt. So like I had mentioned earlier, a lot of times the state, if there's any major life change, such as a marriage or a divorce, birth of a child, death of someone that's close to you, they like for you to wait about a year before you pursue licensing. So if you are going to get married, you might want to wait a little while just to kind of settle in. Or if you're not, we would love to talk to them, and we would love to license them and talk to them about becoming foster parents.
Do you ever license single people?
Yes.
Single men, single women?
Predominantly, I mean, I don't know. I think we have had some single men, more so single women, and sometimes single parents. Sometimes they don't have children, but absolutely. I mean, we look at everyone, and we don't discriminate because foster kids just need a home that can provide structure and love and, you know, routine and nurturance, and a lot of different people can provide that.
How much more complicated is fostering, say, a teenager than a child who's 8 years old? And what kinds of issues is a potential foster parent likely to encounter if they agree to foster a teenager?
Wow. There's different challenges with all of the ages. I mean, teens come into care having so many life experiences. And if you are putting a teenager that has come from a lot of chaos and not a lot of structure or routine, and then try to put them in a home that, you know, is a foster family that's trying to provide that, provide house rules and structure. And there can be a lot of tension with that. There can be a lot of pushback with, you know, with teens. It can be difficult. But then sometimes there are teens, and this kind of goes back to Liz saying it depends, because it really just depends on the child. But sometimes there are teens that really want to get out of that chaotic home life, and they want to have someone who is predictable and stable and will offer them a place to live and a safe home where they can go to school and concentrate on school. And so it really just depends on the child and what their needs are. There's really no easy question or answer as far as, you know, the different issues you might have at different ages, because some 8-year-olds have just as many issues as maybe, you know, a 14-year-old. I mean, if that's like the oldest child in a sibling group, then no matter what their age, they really are kind of adultified and take care of their younger siblings and think that they're in a role where they're in charge. And so that can be a real challenge with foster parents trying to help kids just be kids and not try to take care of everything.
And what kind of services do you provide for foster parents? Because that would be, in a lot of cases, I imagine, a larger responsibility dealing with a kid who has all kinds of trauma kinds of issues.
Yeah, we try to give them a lot of support. We offer ongoing trainings for them. We have monthly meetings for the Foster Parent Association where they can get training that will really help them in their day-to-day parenting of kids that are in foster care. We try to give them, you know, some of the things that they really need to be kind of experts on are loss and grief, because all of these kids have experienced, you know, profound loss by being removed from their birth home. And we also look at trying to give them the tools they need to manage behaviors. We just try to give them as much support. We also set them up with other foster parents that have been as like a mentor that have been fostering for longer. So they have a social worker, but they also have someone that they can call if, you know, they need help or need some advice. And we just really try to give them as much support, because it can be very challenging, and we want them to know how much we need them and how much we appreciate them. And, you know, they're doing it from such a good place, and a lot of them have parented, but that doesn't necessarily prepare them for parenting a foster child, because they just come in with so many more needs because of all the chaos and stress that they've had in their life and trauma.
Liz Kakris-Jones, in your years in the system, you must have seen a lot of kids come and go. Have you seen kids grow up and move on to productive careers? And what is that like for you when you watch a kid grow up in the system?
I'm going to answer that by partly kind of following on what Neela just said. So the Guardian Ad Litem program has a very clear mandate about the best interest, and there are lots of supports that foster parents need, and they are to me, and I always say this when I get a chance to speak with them, they are what make this process work. Children need a place to go, and they are willing to be there at a moment's notice to help children manage what's happening in a very chaotic and traumatic time. And so they need all the supports that the department can offer them, and they need a lot of internal supports for themselves and some really good skills. Having said that, the Guardian Ad Litem program has an association, and we try to help with some of those things that the department can't manage. So things like it's very expensive. Our kids are often behind in school because they've had some instability. So they need to get up to grade level if they're going to be successful, which is kind of to the point of your question. So we offer, we have an association that raises money to help provide things like tutoring and enrichment experiences for our children who are with the Guardian Ad Litem program. And it allows them to kind of focus on being a kid, but get up to grade level, feel some success, so that we get tickets to the aquarium and the battleship and to shows and to just normal experiences that they may not have had in addition to some of those academic supports. And those things then allow for them to move forward if they're older, so that we've seen some real successes for kids. They now have the supports of what is kind of independent living in the Lynx program if they're older and they age out. Age out children are very important to me and sensitive to me. That means they never got permanence. And so some of them have gone on to college.
And when you say, just to be clear, never got permanence, you mean they were either never adopted or they never were able to go back to their family homes?
Yes. Thank you for kind of clarifying that. It means that they never got out of the system before they turned 18. So could have been, you know, permanence for us is not being in DSS custody when you turn 18. Yeah. And so sometimes they've gone on to college. Sometimes they've gone on to vocational training. Sometimes with the combined efforts of the department and the association for guardian ad litem, they've gotten skills or supports, kind of concrete supports around that. And lots of community partners have been responsible for that, and we appreciate every one of those folks. To say that, I want to just also not kind of override the fact that children who do age out are most likely to experience homelessness in their first year. They're most likely to be a victim of a crime their first year out. They're most likely to be in need of mental health services, unemployment services, to be a teen parent. I mean, there are so many things that come up for our youth who don't get that permanent caregiver and permanent support system that the programs that are now evolving around that in terms of independent living are crucial for their success into adulthood.
And these programs now are potentially getting support in the General Assembly. There are at least a couple of pieces of legislation working their way through the Foster Care Family Act. How would that help some of these programs? Liz Kakris-Jones.
Okay. So I don't remember kind of all the details of all of these proposed bills because they get changed along the way.
This one is the reasonable and prudent parenting standard providing liability insurance.
That would be huge for foster parents because that is looking at giving foster parents more parental decisions and letting them allow foster children that are staying with them to go and stay with a friend, to have a sleepover at a friend's house, to go on a church youth trip over the weekend, or, you know, a school trip, go to prom, even like pursue getting their driver's license, where those have all been decisions that have had to be made by the agency where they're in custody. So we're really excited about that because so many kids are in foster care because of no fault of their own. And then they really feel like they're kind of victimized by foster care. And we want them, you know, we want to provide them with a normal life and some normalcy. And they're like, but it's not normal. I can't spend the night at my friend's house or go to prom without having my DSS worker say it's okay. So we're really excited about that. And I think that the federal legislation on that one has passed and we're waiting on the state legislation. But I think that's really a great step towards normalizing foster care and giving foster parents more decisions, decision-making's part of what the foster kids can do.
And there's also another bill, Fostering Success, which is about extending the age of emancipation to 19. Liz Kakris-Jones, can you tell us about that?
Well, I feel like that's a really critical one as well because, as I was saying earlier, if they have school instability, their likelihood of finishing school on time at around 18 has been diminished by the fact that they've probably moved around in schools. And so we often are encouraging them to voluntarily allow the department to help them stay on until they finish school. And so if we don't have to have that negotiation mm-hmm. and just allow them to stay where they are until they can finish school at the age of 19, which is often that 1 year makes a big difference, not only in terms of finishing school, but then establishing skills like how do I get a lease? How do I apply for jobs appropriately? How do I open a bank account? How do I navigate my life as an adult when that type of learning typically happens in a family unit? And so we want to make sure that they have the skills to be successful. And so few 19-year-olds are prepared for those skills.
So when a child reaches the age of 18, as it stands right now, then they are no longer with their foster family? Is that correct? That door just closes?
They can choose to be with their foster family, but they can choose not to be. And so depending on, you know, like many teenagers all over the world, they often think they're fully prepared to be on their own, and then a month later they find out, I don't know how to do a lease. I don't know how to find my own housing. I don't know where to go to get help on any number of things. And so it's really important for them to be able to have time to learn those skills before they make the decision that they don't need the supports of a family around them. It gives them another year, and that's good.
Neely Pelling, how many kids who find foster homes wind up getting adopted?
Last year, we had 65 children that were in foster care that were adopted by either a foster family or by a relative. And that's a pretty significant number. I mean, we really want kids to have permanence. And it can be frustrating for foster parents feeling like, you know, that it does take a while to get to that point. And sometimes kids have been in the same foster home or with a relative for 2 and 3 years and still working that plan of reunification with the parents. And so we really do try to push for permanence for kids. We don't want them aging out of foster care. You know, statistics show that foster care is not a good place for kids to be raised, basically, you know, where you're in foster care. So we really push for that, and it comes to a certain point where the birth family isn't doing what they need to do, and we try to move forward as quickly as we can to provide permanence for children. And we have a lot of people that come to us and want to adopt, and I always tell them that will happen. It might not be the first placement that you have, but if you hang in there with us and you continue to open your heart and your home, we do have plenty of kids that need a forever home.
And just briefly, how many of those kids who were adopted, of those 65, were younger than 12, and how many were older? Do teenagers ever get adopted?
They do. They do. We have, I would say, I don't know what the statistics are. Most of them were probably under 12, but we do have teenagers that are adopted. One of my foster families just recently finalized an adoption of a 16-year-old that has been in their home for the past, I believe he's been there for 2 or 3 years, and they were very committed to him, and he is definitely a teenager with all the things that come along with being a teenager, but they're very committed to him and excited about the future, and it's stories, you know, like that kind of keep us going, because there are really special people out there that want to help teens. You know, I mean, some people are very hesitant to do that, but you know, they're kids, they're teenagers, and all that entails.
That's a great final thought. Liz, just a few seconds left. If you could get one message across about guardian ad litem to the public, what would it be?
That the role of the volunteer is an incredibly powerful and rewarding one, and that it's a great way to be in your community if you care about children and work with a number of really great professionals.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Neely Pelling from New Hanover County's DSS and Liz Kakras-Jones of Guardian Ad Litem. Thanks also to you, our listeners. Join us for next week's Coastline when we take a closer look at diversity on campus. We'll meet UNCW's first diversity officer. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.